I'm Ed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on patreon.com/FUNetworkTV and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com.
Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Stephen. It's the first time we've had a threesome on this on our podcast.
That's right. Neil. Please welcome Neil Wadewitch. Hello, Neil.
Hello.
And Neil is, of course, the host of the Zodcast here on FU Politics. It was a weekly show, and now it's become a series of specials as Neil's life has filled up with very good things, which have great opportunities, which have occupied his time as well as his family. And we look forward to there being, you know, the occasional special whenever you have the time, because you're a great Zodcaster.
I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to be the third Stephen today.
Yes, you're an honorary Stephen. And so today we're going to talk about the occurrences happening in the United States, the protests, which have turned to riots in most cases. It's sort of in response to the death of George Floyd at the hands of a police officer, the man who was accused of passing a bad 20. I don't even know if they determined that he did pass a bad 20. And if he did, maybe he didn't even know. It happened to me. I once passed a bad 5, gave it to a variety store guy. He put it under the light, said it wasn't real. You know, I didn't have to worry about police being called. And if they did come, I would have said, I had no idea. I don't even know where I got this 5, because, you know, bills change hands and so on, or they did before COVID. And so I could have been accused of the very same thing that gentleman was. I didn't have to worry about a policeman coming and kneeling on my neck. For one thing, I'm in Canada, and we don't tend to have officers that do that kind of thing. Not to say that we don't have problems here, not to say that there aren't, especially in certain regions and certain provinces, that there are greater problems than in others, and not to say that there's no bad apples in the police force. And I think that if the police force, members of the police services don't want to be tarred with the brush of the bad cops, then they need to stop this blue wall of silence thing and speak up when there's a bad cop, because it makes all of them look bad. It makes their job harder to do, and it makes their job more dangerous as well. So I'd like something to chip away at that nonsense of the, you know, the brothers in blue, and it's just a bad scene. It's bad for policing. It's bad for society. So we do have things we need to do here in Canada, and we'll get to that a little bit later. But it's important to note that what's going on in the United States is part of a long time, a lot of simmering. Contents under pressure will explode, and they have. The death of Mr. Floyd was the just the spark that lit all that dry tinder that has been there for a long time, just waiting to blow up. And while I don't believe that what's going on in the United States, the destruction and so on, some people say it's self-defense, it's self-defense against the system. I don't believe that for a second. I don't believe that destruction and violence are self-defense. Self-defense is a very easily defined thing, and expanding it to, well, it's the system, so I can do anything against the system or anything that represents the system to me. I don't buy that. But I do buy the notion that they're mad as hell and not going to take it anymore. And that emotion is absolutely valid as a motivation behind what they're doing. Though there is a lot of suggestion that the people who are doing the actual, not turning the protests into riots, aren't in fact people who showed up to protest. They're people who showed up to mingle with the crowd, set shit on fire, and then be able to walk away and let other people wear it. And there's more than ample evidence that this is certainly, at least in some of the cases, this is the possibility that protesters who are gathering there aren't the ones that are actually setting cop cars on fire. They're people who are showing up because they love the anarchy and they just want to see things burn so they can go back home and play their fiddle. What do you think, Stephen, when you see what's going on there in the U.S.? What are your thoughts, your feelings?
This has been a really long arc in the United States' history. I mean, I think we are at a pivot, at a turning point. You could say that this arc started in 1619, when the first 20 slaves were delivered to the United States, and they're still living that legacy today. I mean, you know, theoretically slavery ended in 1865, but the consequences of slavery are things that Americans live with every single day. If nothing more than the black population, I mean, the black population in the United States is overwhelmingly descendant of slaves. And a lot of white people are descendants of slaves too. Once you sort of water it down, you know, you get those ancestry DNA shows and you find white people who show, you know, that they have a little bit of slave DNA in them. You also have the other side of it where you find some black people who go on, have their DNA tested, and then they trace their genealogy back to a slave owner, which wasn't that uncommon because people went down to the slave quarters and raped slaves as part of life. But you have, so from those 20 original slaves, with all the importation of humans from Africa, the United States population now of black people, which is still predominantly the descendants of slaves, is almost 39 million people. So that is a living legacy of slavery. But the other legacy is the economic legacy, that 20% of black people in the United States live in poverty, compared to 10% of white Americans who live in poverty. You know, if you take the prison population, 55% of the prison population is black. Now, you know, if you take the American population at about $380 million, just so my math is easy to do, you know, the black population is maybe 10% of the population, but they represent 55%. And that is an economic underclass, because we know that they're over-prosecuted, that white people are let off, that there's a systemic racism that is harsher and treats them worse. And there's a real legitimate argument to say that the American black prison population is just a new kind of slavery, that it is, you know, especially since they farm out prison populations for cheap labor, whether it's manual labor down in the South, or it's, phone banks and people working, answering your complaint lines. If you're calling about your crappy cell phone service or internet, a lot of those people are actually in American prisons who do that kind of work. And they're being paid about 89 cents a day to do that work. So it's pretty hard to say that that isn't slavery, especially when you have for-profit prisons in the United States. Now, Canada has had a different history. You know, our history of slavery has been sort of slavery light. Not that it, again, doesn't excuse us, but Canada, most of our slaves came with the Loyalists. They came with the Americans, basically, who left the Revolution. And they brought about 4,000 slaves with them. And that was sort of the biggest batch of slaves that Canada had, because we don't have the climate for it. We don't have the agriculture for it. We don't have the industry for it. And we also got rid of slavery earlier. We started getting rid of slavery in 1793, and which said that anyone over the age of 25 who was still a slave had to be freed. And so we sort of grandfathered out, pardon the expression, the slaves in Canada. So, there weren't any slaves well before the American Civil War. And they were never in the big numbers. So socially as a group, Canada hasn't had the same cancer inside. Now, we've got all kinds of other problems. I mean, there's our history of the way we've treated Aboriginal people, and Black people in Canada still are on the pointy end of carding and all kinds of other racially motivated, prejudicial things that the justice system throws at them, and poverty as well in Canada. But for the United States, what they're seeing right now is the way that they have lived, not just in the distant past, but in absolute recent memory, which ends with something like George Lloyd, who theoretically passed a bad $20 bill, knowingly or not, and ends up dead in front of everyone with cameras. And of course, this isn't an outlier either. This has been going on even worse before the age of cell phone cameras. This was commonplace and no one ever heard about it. So there are all of these crimes against Black people that have been happening for ages, and it's finally coming home to roost. Now, if you add into it all the other stuff that has been going on in the United States, the heavy-handed Trump whipping up the people. I mean, even as we speak right now, he's in the middle of a what I can only presume is going to be a two-hour Mussolini-esque speech that he's giving about law and order and catching the agitators and calling out the army and suspending various liberties and rights. That's what people are protesting about. They're tired of this. They're tired of the 1% having tons of money, that there's no jobs. There's no good jobs for people. There's only McJobs and Amazon jobs for people. And they see the inequality growing. They see that the freedoms that Americans traditionally cherish are disappearing. This, free speech, the right to protest. We saw peaceful protesters in Washington outside of the White House being attacked by armed Secret Service agents in full riot gear, pushing them back And all they're doing is voicing their concern. It's because Trump wanted to walk across the street and show that he was still cock of the walk and king of the world and that he wasn't going to be intimidated. So what do? You go out and beat up a bunch of hippies is the way they would put it. I mean, you know, it's right out of Nixon's playbook. And Americans, I think, are getting a little too smart for it and they're getting fed up with it. So like I said, this is a big arc of a lot of historical trends coming together at one time. It's hard to know where it's going to go.
All right. What about you, Neil? What do you think? How do you feel when you see this? And where do you think it's going to go?
I guess that's what the million-dollar question is. And that is something that, for once, I'm ready to put my foot down and to participate in the solution. You know, Stephen was talking about the history of slavery in Canada, and that is a subject that I am woefully, woefully uneducated in. And I think for myself, before I move forward with solutions, I have to look back at the history and see how we got here before where we're going. My observations about what's happening in the States are, one, why were there 4+ police officers to arrest a guy for passing a bad $20 bill? To me, that seems like kind of one of the main genesis of this issue. Secondly, when I look at the police in the United States, we're throwing fundraising drives to buy healthcare professionals PPE in Canada, United States, and police in the United States are outfitted like they're benefactors of Stark Industries. They have this incredible arsenal of weaponry at their hands. And the minute that you bring militarized police officers or law enforcement officials into a situation, I think that is an unnecessary escalation. Now, in regards to the looting, I feel that, yes, I look at the looting and I see it as a problem, but I'm not going to let it take my focus off what is happening. And like you and Stephen, the two Stephens, I see this as a tipping point. I see this as the beginning of something. I haven't felt this way. I didn't feel that way Ferguson, those protests in Missouri in 2012. I didn't see that in New York City with each of the previous times. I didn't see it with Freddie Gray, but I'm seeing that you're even seeing like white professional hockey players, you know, stepping up and making very strong statements in support of this. So I'm hoping that this is the beginning of something and I want to be part of this. In regards to, you know, we're looking at Canada, like, you know, I just read a Rex Murphy column by accident today that said racism doesn't exist in Canada. So maybe we're wrong in that, but I think that we can separate the two situations, but I think that this is a time for us to reconcile the incidents in our past to make sure we don't head down the same street the United States is right now.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, what we're seeing in the States is the product of a refusal of American powers that be and American populace to honestly look at their history with Black people. You know, there's those who say, yeah, Black people are 50-55% of prison population because Black people commit more crimes. And that is such a simplistic and stupid and inaccurate answer. The fact is that, first of all, Black people are the ones who get charged and prosecuted for crimes that white people get a slap on the wrist or just a warning for. The nuisance charges that they put against Black people who don't have the money to afford bail, don't have the money for a good lawyer, and so they wind up in prison. When you don't have the money for a vigorous defense by a properly schooled attorney who really gives a damn, then you're going to wind up in jail. You're going to wind up making deals when you're not guilty just because they threaten you that it's going to be far worse if you don't. And if you're Black, you can believe that you're not going to get a fair choice, a fair shake in court. So we have to face here the legacy of especially how we have treated our Indigenous people. Now, there's all kinds of problems, and there's all kinds of problems in dealing with, rectifying how Indigenous people live and how the government regards them and so on. There's problems that have multiplied because of the number of years that the Indigenous people really felt like nobody gave a damn, and whether people gave a damn or not, they didn't do anything about it. So it leads to a tremendous amount of mistrust. There's some Native communities where there's reverse osmosis water that has been put in a pump, but they don't trust the government. They don't trust the people who put it in. It's like in the United States, Black men don't go to doctors because there's still that specter of the Tuskegee experiments. And so they just don't trust doctors. and they wind up dying of heart disease and so on when they could be treated because of just this legacy of mistrust. And we have to stop feeling injured when Indigenous people are saying things that sometimes might seem inflammatory because they're mad as hell and don't want to take it anymore. And it's not great as tactics, but it's honesty. And we have to look at that and say, okay, we can't be smug and say we're not as bad as the U.S., so that's okay. That's not a yardstick. I don't give a damn how good or bad the U.S. is. I care about how good or bad we do here. And all the liberal hand-wringing and pearl-clutching on social media by people who will do nothing but post on social media and do nothing to actually be part of the problem, that doesn't help anything. You know, good, you're calling attention to the fact that you're so righteous and virtuous, but tweets don't solve problems. Tweets are great at causing problems. They're not so good at solving problems.
Steven. So,
yes.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but for everyone who's out there virtue signaling, for people who are, you know, like we've spoken before about the Trudeau blackface thing, people are commenting, people are making negative comments on the protests or, you know, trying to make themselves look better by criticizing others. You know, I came from a small Northern Ontario town. I didn't have a lot of interaction with people of color, admittedly, before I left there. I'm not going to lie, I have said intolerant things in my past, but I've come to terms with that, and I've reconciled that, and I think that we have to do a lot more of that in Canada. You know, for once, you know, it's a really complicated situation, and the way I'm trying to approach this is, how can I be an ally here? How can I be an ally to my friends who are of color? How can I be an ally to people who are Indigenous? What can I do to help? What can I do with my platform to try and do something good here? And it's not virtue signaling. I just think it's damn time that we have this conversation, that it's had. And we get it all out there. We get it all out there.
Yeah. How about you, Stephen? Your thoughts?
No, well, absolutely. And, you know, in Canada's, you know, Canada still has a persistent problem that's systemic. As a lawyer, I look at something like the Colton Bushy case, and it was an absolute travesty of justice. The facts and the outcome and the fact that a system would not be able to secure a conviction in a case like that, where, you know, in my opinion, the defense that was raised was clearly inadequate, but it was a jury not of First Nation peers found that the person was justified in shooting Colton Bushy.
Stephen, for those who haven't kept up on that case, could you give us a quick synopsis?
Sure. This goes back, I think, about a year and a half now. It was a case where some Indigenous people were out driving around, and they pulled into someone's yard. Now, the stories are a little bit different at this point. The Aboriginal group, there's a number of young men who said that they were having car trouble, or they were looking, and they pulled into someone's a rural property, theoretically to seek assistance, they were looking at the property. Nothing was stolen, nothing was broken, but the property owner decided he wanted to scare them off and came out with a gun. And when they tried to get away, he stuck the gun inside of the car. He said he was trying to stop the car. But the gun went off and shot Colton Bushy, an Aboriginal man, through the head. And he said, the gun went off accidentally. And it's pretty much anyone who knows guns. He said it was a hang fire, which is where you pull the trigger, the hammer goes down, and the powder doesn't burn immediately. It doesn't go bang. It fizzles. And then a couple seconds later, it goes bang. Now, hang fires happen at a shooting range anywhere else, but this was, I think, I don't have it right off the top of my head, but it was like a half minute, and that doesn't happen. You know, so he was saying, and it just happened to be pointing at him at the time. So, number one, you know, yes, these people are on your property, but it's sort of an American stand your ground kind of idea, which doesn't exist in Canada. I mean, if you have someone on your property, you can yell at them and call the cops, but you can only meet deadly force with deadly force. You shouldn't be walking around with a gun chasing people off your property. That is not what it is. And if you do, and if you shoot someone who isn't an imminent threat to you in Canada, then you will be charged with attempted murder, because it doesn't matter that you were protecting your property. You know, the Americans have this stand your ground, which is blaze away at anyone you think is a problem. You have no right, you know, no obligation to retreat, no obligation to finesse or be nice. So Colton Bushy, as an Aboriginal man, was shot. They found a gun in the car, but the gun they found in the car was an old rusted, I think it was like an 1898 lever action rifle that had no stock on it and was, you know, it was almost impossible to fire, and no one was pointing it at anyone. It was just on the floor of the back seat. So, you know, they tried to spin this whole yarn that he was an imminent threat and had this gun and all the rest, but none of that was proved. But however, the white jury, I believe it was Saskatchewan, said that could have been me. You know, sure, you got your right to defend your homestead against against marauding Indians. So, you know, they didn't convict, and the Crown just eventually said, we're not even going to appeal this. We have no prospect of success. So that, I think, was incredibly disheartening to our Aboriginal communities, because it shows that the justice system, forget being on their side, it just won't even give them a fair shake.
Well, I mean, that's disturbing to me that they figured that even if they retried it, it would get the same result. That just shows that the Crown is aware of the overwhelming bias against Native people, or certainly, if you even the best case scenario, the overwhelming bias towards people being able to use firearms if somebody's on their property, not causing any violence, not threatening any violence, but just the fact that they're there, it makes them fair game. The fact that that mentality is so rife in that particular pocket of you know, society, that the Crown didn't even think that there would be a different result if they did it again. I would have tried it again anyways. Who cares? Maybe you get a different result, but I understand they have to pick their fights because they only have so much money to spend in bringing cases to trial. That's very disheartening, not just for Natives. It's disheartening for me as a Canadian to know that there is a pocket of our society where they would side with somebody who shouldn't. If you want to take the gun and point it at the ground just to scare them, that's one thing. I still don't agree with it, but at least you point it at the ground. When I was a kid, my mother always told me, even when we were using guns, my mother didn't want us to have any toy guns. And so we would take toilet paper rolls and make them into, you know, bang bang guns and things like that. And she always said, even when it was just guns we made with arts and crafts, don't point it at somebody. Don't point that at anyone's face. Don't point it. Mm-hmm. And these were not guns that could ever shoot any projectile. But I learned early on, don't point a gun at somebody. And the fact that the gun went off by accident, even if that were true, it shouldn't have been pointed at any human being at all. And I understand why Natives are going to feel like this is an example of how they're not getting proper justice. Neil?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, even for myself in the past, you know, having hunted, you don't point your gun at something you don't intend on shooting. I mean, even if you aim and shoot at a duck, at whatever, after you shoot, you put your gun into a safe position. You know, so you do not, I mean, even he wasn't intending on using the gun. In fact, he had it pointed at Colton Bushy when it went off, this so-called dry fire or whatever it was, says that he has some type of criminal, even the fact they didn't find him guilty, he had criminal responsibility in the death of Colton Bushy. Even if he had pointed to him, the gun went off by accident, you do not point a gun at somebody or something you don't intend on shooting.
That's right.
And the Colton Bushy case is just sort of, you know, the most egregious public example of that kind of racism that happens. You know, and you see it, you know, it's not just out in Saskatchewan, Northern Ontario or Alberta. I mean, you know, Toronto has its fair share of Indigenous people who are, you know, who often constitute an underclass here and are treated badly. But, you know, this for Aboriginal people in Canada is just the most public tip of the iceberg of the kind of systemic racism that they experience on a daily basis. You know, and you know, Black people in Canada as well. I mean, it's certainly not quite the same as the United States. I mean, you know, there are certain parts of community policing that have treated the Black community very, very badly in Canada. But in the United States, I mean, you have this tension. If you watch CNN at all, they've had a series of mayors on talking about their police relationships with Black communities in their towns. And one of the most interesting things I found after watching it over and over and over again, that a lot of these mayors of American towns, small and large, are Black women. So when we're talking about racism, but we have these women who are Black, who have made it to the top of municipal politics. And some of them there are multi-term people. And there was an interesting article in New Yorker magazine, I think it's this week, about the tension between these Black women liberal mayors and their police departments and their attorneys general and prosecutors, and how they can't get buy-in by their police departments to have more community policing, to be a little more informed in the way that they police the Black community. But the mayors need the police. So what you get is the police sometimes, if they get called out to, you know, a public gathering like we're seeing over the last week, because it was a week ago, right, you know, that we did our last recording, and all of this has happened in the last week, all of these riots, all these congregations of people, these protests, peaceful and otherwise, the police will say, okay, Madam Mayor, let me show you how much you need us. We're going to step back and let them burn down a few things before we step in and do anything. And then people are going to start screaming that they need us to come in with the militarized, you know, with the tanks and the tear gas and the weapons and the riot gear. And you know, so even these liberal Black women mayors can't get at the systemic racism that happens in all these American cities.
It's interesting you make that point. And I think about the protest that took place here in Toronto and the one that took place in Montreal. The one in Montreal ended in a shambles, unfortunately. But I admit that the first time I saw photos of the people massed out front of Toronto police headquarters and heard that they had to be, you know, pushed back, they were trying to get into the building, I thought, these are people who are jumping on a bandwagon, because we do not have the same kind of problems here in the same kind of numbers that they have in the United States. I find Canadian cops, I find there are bad ones. And my wife and I have dealt with a couple of bad cops. My wife had a stalker for a number of years. She's still out there. And it was a female stalker. And we dealt with a female police officer who was investigating it. And even though we had reams of information, emails and all this other stuff showing that there was a clear threat by this woman and so on, like to the point that my wife was concerned about the fact that the woman knew where we lived. She was afraid for a long time about her coming to the house, because this woman has a history of violence and is unsettled. The female police officer, after doing an investigation, determined it's just two women who don't like each other. And we were flabbergasted that she was basically saying it's just a cat fight, you know, and that's bad policing. It was terrible policing. And when we tried to speak to her supervisor, she first hung up the phone, went and talked to her supervisor. And by the time we got through to the supervisor, she'd already spun a tale about that was not true about this whole situation. So I've dealt with bad police, and there are other circumstances, but I've dealt with good police too. And what I find is Canadian police recognize that they are there to serve the public. American police believe they are above the public. This is just what I have seen. It's anecdotal evidence, which take it for what it's worth. But this is the attitude I've seen. When that terrorist, that incel, drove his van in North York and killed people, drove on the sidewalk, killed people, injured people, he wanted to have suicide by cop. He was telling the cops, shoot me, shoot me. And the lead cop there said, no, I'm not going to shoot you. Put down your gun. Now, in the States, that guy would have been ventilated like Swiss cheese. But here we have a professional police force that said, no, I'm not shooting you. Put it down. And the guy eventually surrendered. And now, of course, people are going to say, what happened to Sammy Yateem? What happened to Sammy Yateem is a police officer who should never have been a police officer, who did not have the constitution or the nerves or the fortitude to be able to handle a tense situation. And he panicked, and he shouldn't have been a police officer. I don't believe he went into it saying, I'm going to kill this Middle Eastern kid. I think he just freaked out and lost his mind. And as a result, he served time in prison. So when people bring that up, I say, look, the cop served time in prison, which is extraordinary. In the States, if they get a slap on the wrist, it's something. A lot of them are found not guilty by white juries. which is, it just goes to show how far we have really diverged from the United States. Like, at this point, the divergence is so wide, the chasm is so wide, I don't see us ever, the U.S. would have to start coming more to our side. I don't see us going to their side. I don't see us adopting that kind of intolerance. Because in the state, I have friends in the States, people who claim that they're not racist, but they're racist. You know, they say, oh,
it's a relative term down there.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, they're not racist, but it's like, oh, I don't hate them because of the way they are. That's just the way they are. They can't help it. It's like, do you not recognize how racist that is? Oh, but I don't hate them. You know, you don't even have the words, the vocabulary. You realize that you can't, you don't even have a common ground to start with. And these people, when I discovered that this is their attitude, these people who were friends become very, very distant acquaintances, because I try to talk them out of it. I try to talk sense to them. It doesn't do any good. And then I just determined that these, you know, the bloom's off the rose. I'm not interested in hanging out with people like this. I lost a good portion of my family to prejudice with the Nazis. I don't have any patience for it. And so I don't have patience for it in anybody else either. And I think that's the thing, is that we all need to speak up when we're in groups of white people. Or I don't consider myself white, because I know that when I was working at CBC on a TV show, on a panel show I was producing, and every day of the three panelists, one person could be just general. One person had to be a woman, one had to be a person of color, or a minority. And when a black person canceled at last minute, the only person I could think to call last minute was somebody who was Jewish. And I was told, no, Jews aren't a minority. It's like, really? Have you looked at the numbers? Have you looked at the fact that anti-Semitic number cases top the number of racist hate crimes every year and keeps increasing? No, Jews aren't minorities. It's like, I don't feel like a white person. Thank you very much. Even though I might look like one. So I feel for it. I understand it. And I think, though, that and I don't fault people of color for this, but the ones who are on social media saying white people just need to shut up and can't have an opinion, that isn't what we need. Is a dialogue, not a lecture, either in either direction. What we need is a dialogue. We need open minds on both sides. We need people to be able to recognize who are allies and who are people who want to be allied and just are seeking information and may put it, the question in a clumsy manner. But I've got somebody on social media who always assumes that I'll put up a tweet supporting him, and he comes back with something that indicates he thinks I'm attacking him. When I'm supporting him the whole time, but he's just, that's just his sensitivity, the lived experiences he's had. He doesn't trust anybody who looks like me. And that's disheartening. And I'd like to work towards a time in Canada where there's always going to be some of that. I'd like to work towards a time when nobody feels the need, or the majority of people of color don't feel the need to judge somebody based on their skin color. The easiest way to put it. Neil, what do you think? I see you nodding.
Okay, so I think that for every vocal racist, whether it be on social media, or I'd always laugh, I'm not on Facebook, right? But in reading my wife's Facebook, I said, it's great, now I know which of my relatives and aunts are racist. But for every loud vocal racist, there's 1,000 silent ones. And I think it's the silence that I'm taking issue with. Now, we're talking about Sami Yateem. I think that a large portion of that problem would be that they don't have police officers or law enforcement or enough of them that are educated in mental health, in de-escalating mental health situations. I think that for people of color, for racialized people, that to have police officers who can de-escalate mental health issues would be vitally important. Do I have any answers? I try to be all full of solutions. And what I'm trying to do right now is just listen, to observe what's happening, to pay attention to the voices that I feel are looking to add to the, to the conversation. And, you know, trying to keep my elbows down on social media through this. I'm having my say. Like today I said to, you know, I've been watching a lot of Canadians clap themselves in the back. And my point was, we had a national media last year that melted down at the word of the use of the word genocide and the murder of missing Indigenous and women girl in the report. And I said, yes, we are worlds apart from the United States. My concern is that not to let us ever get there. Like you said, that it would be highly doubtful that it happens, but I'm really just trying to learn how to be an ally to people of color, and to just like the way we were with you know, the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual community, that we can do the same thing, that I can focus the same attention and energy on being an ally to people of my friends and fellow Canadians who are people of color.
Yeah. All right, before I go ahead, Stephen.
No, I was just going to say, and the sad thing is, and I think this is one of the differences that we can be proud of in Canada, is that there are no shortage of people in the United States, starting with the Commander-in-Chief. Trump right now is still giving his speech where he's talking about law and order, and he's fanning the flames of this mythology that, you know, that Antifa is behind all of this, that it's a couple of agitators, and discredit the entire, you know, not just discredit the entire unhappiness that's going on in the United States, which is, you know, it's, you know, the touchstone was George Floyd, but it is all of these inequities, all of the things that Trump has been doing in his administration, and it's boiling to the surface. But what he's doing is he's trying to mobilize an us versus them, which is how he has run his entire presidency, and saying, look, it is the thin blue line. It's, you know, I'm going to get the Secret Service out there, and they're just spoiling for a fight, and I'm going to mobilize the National Guard, and I'm going to, you know, get the military out there, and it, you know, they are the people standing between you and anarchy, and all these other people, they are just troublemakers. It's like when you saw the people at Washington that were being cleared from in front of the White House, who were having a peaceful protest. From what I could see in television, most of them were white professional urban professors and those kinds of people. This wasn't an angry mob. It wasn't a violent mob. There was no looting. There was no throwing of rocks. There, you know, they were booing pretty loudly Trump, which is, you know, one of the constitutional rights. But, you know, he's demonizing all of those people. And sure, there has been looting. There has been all kinds of problems. You know, things get out of hand. There's people who are venting their frustration. You know, strangely enough, one crowd decided to vent its frustration on CNN in Atlanta. It's like, CNN, they're the ones who are giving your side of the story. You know, if you want to go after someone, they're not Fox News. They, you know, these are allies. When we're talking about allies, CNN is very sympathetic to the problems that are going on right now. But Trump is, and his little coterie is using this as their Reichstag fire moment, where, you know, they can, you know, push the boundaries of laws to allow a little bit more jackbootism in the United States, and instill the fear in enough voters that they're going to be okay with it.
Yeah, you know, it's the point you make is quite valid. I think that what happens when violence occurs with these protests is it discredits the protesters, and what it does is it feeds into the narrative that they need that good people need someone to protect them from these individuals, and here comes Trump stepping in for law and order. The irony of that, there has not been a president since Nixon, and I think Trump has exceeded Nixon, who has so subverted the rule of law in the United States. He's just thumbed his nose at it and actually given the middle finger to it. Nobody I can think of in modern history has so subverted and eroded the rule of law in the United States like Trump, and yet he steps up for law. When he means law and order, what he means is his law and his orders.
Yeah,
and that's not law and order. And I think that when it comes to talking about racism in Canada, this is something I've found. I grew up in a community that had a percentage of which was Jewish. The rest was not. And I experienced anti-Semitism all through my elementary school years, even from teachers who thought that they should be patted on the back for allowing me to exist in Canada, even though I was born here, my parents were born here. So I know what racism feels like. I felt it. And in fact, I just completed a tour of duty, so to speak, with a client who in the end was not just anti-Indigenous, but an anti-Semite. And the work concluded because of the fact that this person was an anti-Semite. And I'm not the one who points at everything and says, it's anti-Semitism. You know, there's some people who point at everything that they're responsible for, or their failings, and they blame whatever their group is part of. I'm not like that. So if I say that it's anti-Semitism, it's anti-Semitism. Everything else has been ruled out. But what I found as I grew older is far less anti-Semitism what I found is people aren't so much racist as they just don't care. I don't think people, there's a lot of people out there that are anti-Semitic. I think they simply just don't care. And people being Jewish isn't something that's on their mind day to day. It's not something they focus on. So they're not anti-Semitic. They're just apathetic. And while that may be bad, it's not as bad as active racism. And people are saying there's active racism going on. No, I think mostly what there is indifference. And indifference allows those who actually are racist to conduct themselves in a way that's just completely unacceptable. Neil?
Well, it's, you know, as a white male, raised Catholic, I haven't really experienced anti-Semitism. I haven't experienced intolerance. I've never had it directed at me, and I've had to learn to be very conscious of listening to the stories of others who've experienced, like, listening to your stories. It's like that old joke said, you know, how does every racist joke start? Looking over your shoulders, right? Because yeah. They want to keep it secret. They want to keep it, and they want to give the appearance of being nice people. And I think that for myself, it was acknowledging maybe some of my past intolerances and some of the ignorant views that I may have held when I didn't know better, and coming to terms with that. So it's hard for me to, it's better for me to listen to your experience and listen to what you're saying and listen to your story, because that's the only way that I'll be able to relate to it. And that's kind of my difficulty in participating in this conversation. I'm observing it, I'm watching it. I felt incredibly unsettled, almost just like existential dread in watching these riots. And I'm not using riot in a derogatory way. It's more of a term of convenience for me here, but in watching this, and I'm hoping that either that this doesn't escalate and turn into something bad and something tragic, that this is the beginning of something, that beyond the looting, beyond the burning of things, beyond the people who are there, not for the cause, but to be assholes, and I'm sorry for using that word, but you know, just to cause damage. I'm hoping that beyond this, that this is the start of something. How hopeful am I for that? Not very much, but you know, the Trump presidency is turning out exactly like how I thought the Trump presidency was going to turn out. He's not there to soothe the nation. He's not there to be an orator like Obama was. He's in it to look like the strong man. He seems like one of those people that is trying to compensate for something. And unfortunately, the Americans elected him, and now they're going to have to find a way out of it.
All right, Stephen?
Yeah, well, I think it's really interesting. The right has always had this mythology, and this is one of the reasons they need to keep their guns. It's to prevent tyranny. It's to rise up against a tyrannical government and to take back the power and give it to the people when, you know, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. That, you know, that is the, you know, the Fox News, Breitbart stock and trade. What we're seeing though right now is the left, and I'm using the left in the biggest possible sense, because these people may not even identify themselves as left. I think they're just decent people. A lot of them happen to be on the left, but, what we're seeing in the United States may well be exactly what the right has always been preparing for itself, which is the people who've had enough. It's the Boston Tea Party that they are, you know, which was the destruction of property, by the way, that they are people who see a tyrannical government that is taking away their liberties, that is subverting the fundamental justices and civil rights of its citizenry, and they're taking to the street because they've had enough of it. And I think that's what Trump is really worried about. I was shocked to find out that on Saturday night, Trump actually ended up in the bunker. He was worried enough that what was going on in the United States was threatening to him personally, because it's always personal with Trump, that he went down to the Situation Room, the war room, the secure place underneath the White House for his own security. And it's like, okay. At the moment, it's a bunch of people setting fire to Target, and you know, and looting the dollar stores. But is that reaching into the White House? I mean, that gives you a sense of his sense of fear and a sense of self-importance. But I think in the big picture, a lot of Americans are actually saying, no, this is an insurrection against an unjust government that has subverted the rule of law, that has perverted the Department of Justice to its own means, that is corrupt, that is venal, that is in, you know, making deals with foreign governments and robbing the treasury to enrich themselves. And as patriots, not the way that the right uses patriots, but real patriots, we need to rise up and tell them that we will not take this anymore. So I think that's what we're seeing going on in the United States, whether it spreads out to the people you're talking about, Stephen, which is the, you know, the indifferent, the people who just like, I don't want to get involved. But we're seeing more and more people taking their children down to these protests to show them, look, we are taking back America. We are saying that this is not the way things should be done here. And we're going to stand here and we're going to be, you know, we're not going to throw Molotov cocktails, but we are going to voice our dissatisfaction with this government, which you'd think is the first right any American would lay claim to.
Yeah, and you know what, I think they're not just talking about this particular government, they're talking about this government's vision of America, the vision of America they're trying to impose, and the America they're trying to replace. And in one sense, as depressing as this is, there is also a heartening side to it, that many people are saying, no, the vision of Trump's America is not our vision of America. We're not gonna stand for this. We're not going to stand for a continual erosion of the rule of law. We're not going to stand for the erosion of our standard of living. We're not going to allow for the underclass to be continually perpetuated. We've had enough. And I think that America really needed this to open its eyes. Like they need racism, and they need the results of racism shoved in their face, like you do with a dog that soils the carpet. You need to put their face in it so they recognize they can't turn away. Because Americans are great at turning away, and Americans are great at saying that if you say anything other than America is the greatest country in the history of the world and we're number one at everything, if you point out any flaws or any places America could do better, then you hate America, as opposed to the fact that you're pointing out these flaws because you want America to be as good as it can be because you love America. And we love Canada, so there is nothing anti. It is absolutely 100% Canadian to voice concerns about not just our own, you know, ethnic community or our own identity community, but that of others. Not to usurp their voice, but to augment their voice. Because quite frankly, the only, you know, when I was working at, as an example, I was working at Much Music for many years, and they would not cover Carabana. The black producers would lobby to have Carabana covered, and they wouldn't cover Carabana. Now, I'm not saying they're racist. They just didn't. They were afraid of, you know, okay, there would always, every year there'd be some kind of violent incident, and they were concerned about safety and stuff, which was just bullshit. That's one of those deep-seated, those are black people, there's going to be violence. Then we covered Woodstock 99, took a huge crew out there, and RVs and stuff like that, and that went to hell, and that was mostly white people, white middle-class people, just spoiled and pissed off and heat-stroked, and they destroyed property, they set fire to things. And, you know, I said afterwards, so we'll cover that Woodstock. And if they have another Woodstock in 6 months, we'll go again, but we won't cover a Carabana. And I had my character, Ed the Sox, say this on the air. And wouldn't you know it, they started covering Carabana. But that was because somebody who wasn't black said that this was not right. Black people, they kept saying, you're just too close to it. And the point I'm making with this is that you need, if the white people are the people who are in charge, and if I'm perceived as being white, there is a responsibility on our shoulders to step forward, because we'll be listened to. Black people, there's the, you know, who advocate for this stuff. They're important voices, but they need us to augment. They need us to magnify or amplify their voices, because people are going to write off black people saying they're oversensitive, they're too close to it. But if, when white people start speaking up and saying, no, that isn't true, what they're talking about is legitimate and it has basis and we need to do something about it, that's when stuff starts to happen. And we do have a responsibility to say, I understand their anger and I might not like the way that anger is playing out, but you know what? We don't get to judge the way anger plays out. Anger plays out the way anger plays out. And if we've been too complacent and allowed this shit to happen to the point where these people are this fed up, this afraid, this willing to just go out there and put themselves out there in front of police and so on, if we've let it get to this point, we have a hand in allowing it to get there. We also can have a hand in building bridges. And all of us need to take out our metaphorical hammer and nail and boards and start building those goddamn bridges, because they need us to help them. Sometimes they think that's patronizing. I'm not trying to be patronizing. I'm saying that the people that are in the positions of power currently need to cede that power. And the only way that's going to happen is by those who are seen as their peers step up and say, what these people are saying, it is legitimate, and we need to do something. And just tweeting on Twitter, there is value to that. But we need to do more than that. We can't allow this stuff to continue. We have to say, this is not enough. What's being done for our Indigenous community is not enough. What's being done to help to make people of color feel more comfortable, it's not enough. We need to do more. And that means that when somebody starts about to tell a joke and they do this, we say, okay, no, I'm not willing to listen to this. You don't have to make a big deal. You can just say, you know what, I'm going to walk away. And you'd be surprised how many people will walk away with you at that point in time, but people are afraid to be the first.
I was waiting for someone to walk away first, though.
That's right. And you got to be the one to walk away first. Mm-hmm. And that person will stand there looking like an ass and probably was only going to offer that joke because they thought that they would get validation. When they don't get validation, that's the last time they'll try to offer that joke. Neil, and then Stephen, and then we'll wrap it up.
Okay, so, I mean, how do we have this conversation with right or the indifferent who feel, the entitled, who feel that something to be given, for something to be given to someone else, to bring immigrants into this country, to listen to people of color, to give people of color equality, that something is being taken away from them, right? Let's take Canada back. Let's take back what was taken from us. We have to find a way to convince them to lose that mindset. I mean, you look at every conservative leadership candidate has this taking Canada back platform, you know, take it back from who exactly? In the United States, how can you fight tyranny when the government is trying to convince you that you're the tyranny, right? And further to your point that, you know, I'm not gonna say that they need us, but it's time for us to step up and to do our part and to add our voices to theirs. I just feel that I have this daughter who's 17, who's turning 18, and I'm observing her watching the world through new eyes, and it's spurring me to an action that I haven't felt before. It's what kind of changed how I do on social media. It convinced me to start the podcast. It convinced me to start working with you. Is that I have to have my say. I have to be able to tell the people who look up to me that I did something. And I think that if more people develop that attitude, I think if we can develop that sense of community, to develop that sense of sameness, that we do not succeed unless the people who are on the bottom succeed, right? That it's not about my success, it's about the success of all. And I'm not trying to sound like a commie or a socialist in saying this, but I mean just for the good of public, to make sure that we get to the Canada that we want, that we get, the Americans get the America that they want, that nothing is being taken away from anyone. So
okay, well, I mean, what you're talking about is what my wife calls supportive capitalism, which is that it's not socialism. We're putting in stop gaps so that capitalism can flourish and more people can participate in it, which is the nature of capitalism. It's, you know, it's competition, it's people being able to participate. And as for how do we convince people on the right that they need to step up, well, I know the way you don't convince them is to yell at them, is to moralize at them and to lecture them and to treat them like they are bad people. That is the greatest way to get them to retrench and not even consider what their thoughts are. Don't attack them. There's a great story about the son of a leading neo-Nazi white supremacist in the United States who went to a university, and a Jewish student who every week, Friday night, had a Sabbath dinner for people of all backgrounds. And he invited this neo-Nazi, this heir to a neo-Nazi organization, to come to the Sabbath dinner, Jewish Sabbath dinner. And the guy came. And the guy disavowed his father and the movement. Why? Because somebody welcomed him in. If they had just yelled at him, that he just would have retrenched and gone back to the people who would have backed him up. But somebody showed kindness and opened his hand, and this person, to his credit, took that olive branch and looked in and saw that these people who I say are horrible, they're good people. Because ignorance and racism can only flourish really, in places where people are not able to encounter people of other faiths, other ethnicities, other origins. And if we yell at them and all automatically assume that they're pieces of shit, then they have every reason to say, I'm not listening to you. I don't want to be lectured to. I don't want to be told I'm a bad person just because of the color of my skin. You got to bring them around gently, because you have to believe that at their core, most people are good people. Some people just have been raised with some crazy ideas, have not been exposed to people of color or people of different faiths and so on. And by yelling at them, we're just confirming for them that they are, that we are on opposing sides. You can't yell at people. You can't lecture people. You got to try to assume that they're good. There's a good person in there. Like Luke Skywalker in Return of the Jedi believed there was still some good left in Darth Vader. We have to try to ignite that spark of decency in them. And you don't do that by making them your opponent. Stephen, you'll get the last word.
Oh, wow. I think Canada's greatest strength is that for all of our imperfections, for all the ways that we fail, people of color, Aboriginals, people in the LGBTQ community, Canada at least has an aspirational value in being fair, in being just, in being tolerant, in looking after people who are not able to look after themselves, whether it's because of whether it's through our social welfare system or our healthcare system. And we're now in Ontario and across Canada have a big dialogue that has started on long-term care homes, because they deserve better, and Canadians believe that people deserve better and to be treated decently. I'm heartened by the fact that in the last two elections, parties that were xenophobic, that were anti-immigrant, that were take Canada back. I mean, we all know that that's code. I mean, who are we taking it back from? Well, we're taking it back from all, we're taking them back from the blacks and the gays and the Jews and the, the whiny socialists and it's code for all of those people, aimed at white people who want it to go back to the 1950s version of Canada, which never really existed.
Man or man.
The way they think it did, it never really was like that. Canada wants to be on the right path. We want to look after people. We do want a just society, to borrow a phrase from 1968, that we want to have a colorblind, in the best possible sense, community where people are judged by their abilities and not by their what family they came from, how long they've been in this, whether they're old stock Canadians or they just arrived. We have so many success stories that we celebrate that way. Now, we have all kinds of problems, and we've talked about some of them, the way we failed terribly the Aboriginal communities in Canada, the way that we can do better, and we're very late to recognize LGBTQ rights, the way that race is still and poverty is still a shame to Canada. But I think we don't want it to be that way. The difference is, I say, in a lot of the United States, they're fine with it. Because they don't want to rock the boat. They're worried that their place in the pecking order is, the pie is going to get smaller. They're not going to have their fair share. It's going to be tougher for them to get into a college or get a job if we're giving, equality to women or to visible minorities. And I think that's one of the things that makes Canada very different from the American experience. I mean, we didn't have that cancer of slavery that continues to resonate in American society. We don't have the crazy prosperity gospel Christianity that has poisoned the United States, and continues to do it right now. We don't have the gun nuts as part of basically a religious faith here. So we have a lot of things going in our favor, and we resist. There still are, and we're seeing in the current race for a conservative leader federally. Those are still strong themes that they try to play to, whether it's fundraising with the gullible and the scared, my friend Heather Mallett calls them, the angry white pajamas, the people who yell, stand on their lawn and yell at the paper boy.
You mean Rex Murphy?
Well, I'm not saying I'm saying Heather Malick's a friend. I don't know Rex Murphy. Okay. But I think Canada aspires to be very different, and the United States has given up on that that aspirational role, except for the people who are taking those streets right now, because they know that America can and should be better. Whether they can shake off the chains of history and become better is what we're going to find out in the next 6 months.
All right. I think that's a good place for us to bring it in for a landing. For those out there who say, hey, it's two white guys and a Jew who's kind of a white guy talking about issues facing minorities. These are the kind of conversations that have to happen amongst people who are not of color or not considered visible minorities. We all need to have these conversations and these dialogues. We all need to be open and willing to listen. And we need to talk amongst ourselves as well about how to make things better for everybody else. So I don't think that this conversation has been invalidated by the color of our skin, since none of us are denying that there's still problems. All of us want to be part of the solution and work to become part of that. So, for other people out there who look like us or sound like us, you can look to us and say, okay, I can see myself in one or all three of these gentlemen. And if they're feeling this way, it's okay for me to step up and speak, because some people are just waiting for someone else to be the first. And after that, they're willing to jump in. And I'm not going to criticize them for that. That's a human, kind of a human failing. It's the human condition. But I hope we've contributed to that conversation today. There's a lot more conversation needs to happen. And you know what? There comes a point in time where conversation needs to stop and action needs to happen. And I think we're past that point now. But conversation is a bit of a catalyst to help get things going. So, Neil, thank you for joining us as an honorary Stephen for this podcast. Wishing you continued success, and we hope there's more Zodcasts in the future coming to FU Politics.
Yeah, and I just want to say that I've been a big fan of your podcast, the Stephen and Stephen podcast. It's an honor to be part of it. It's one of the few podcasts that I promote to people who may not necessarily be in politics, but, you know, to listen to engaging conversation that isn't, you know, you're not being purposely belligerent in how you're expressing things. So thank you for having me on. And, thank you for, this is the FU platform, the FU Politics platform is absolutely amazing. And I look forward to bringing more Zodcasts back to drag the discourse down. So.
All right. Thank you, Neil. Stephen, I'll let you say goodnight.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. And like I say, Neil, thank you for joining us. I say this is the first time we've had someone on, and I think we'll do it again. You know, it means a third less talking for both of us. So it's great. And it's also great for our listeners too, who get tired of just hearing the two of us talk. So thank you. Thank you, Neil. And Neil, we always like to do this. If you follow Neil on Twitter at now it's Way to Witch. W-A-Y-T-O-W-I-C-H Neil. So at Way to Witch Neil on Twitter. And so you're not on Facebook. Like I say, I always like to say Twitter is where you find brand new friends, and Facebook is where you wonder about the friends that you have.
Kitten videos he's not seeing.
Yeah, it's true. And of course, Stephen Kirzner, who can be found on Twitter at Stephen with a V. J. Kirzner, K-E-R-Z-N-E-R. And I'm Stephen Lawtens at Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, spelled properly, L-A-U-T-E-N-S. That's the three of us on Twitter. So thank you for joining us. And I think there's a little bit of a commercial at the end here that Stephen Kirzner is so good at.
Thank you very much. And we'll have to agree to disagree on the correct spelling of Stephen. I think both are equal. Just different. Yes, we're starting a bit of a challenge and a bit of a fundraising thing here on FU Politics, because we know that we're getting between 10 to 15,000 downloads a month, which when you look at the math of online, they say three times more people stream than download. So you look at those numbers, that's an awful lot of people that are listening. We're by the time we've been on the air a year, we'll have had a million listeners. Or a million listens to our podcasts, which is insane. So we're offering a challenge. We need to be able to buy and maintain our equipment. We have some equipment now that's through repeated use coming to the end of its life. And we need to repair computers. We need to fix computers. We need to buy computers. We need to have video cameras. We need to have people able to man those cameras. because we're hoping to bring FU Music to life, which will be the spiritual successor to Much Music. There's so much we want to do, because our programming here is we aim to be authentic, to bring people on who are not paid political pundits or you know, political partisans. We want people who are just well-informed, well-intentioned, to come on and share their opinions, no matter which part of the spectrum they're from. We reach out to conservatives and liberals alike. And we hope to sound like you because we are you. And in order to keep this going and to keep this kind of grassroots, relatable programming going, we need a little bit of, you know, oil for the mechanism. So what we're asking is, yes, Stephen, get to it. Just, we're asking everyone to just give us a dollar, to just contribute a dollar towards keeping this initiative going and growing. Just a dollar, because we have so many people listening. If enough people give a dollar, that will help us get to the next level that we're seeking to get to. You can do it either by becoming a monthly subscriber for a dollar a month on Patreon, which is Patreon with an E, patreon.com/FU Network TV. Or if you want to just contribute a one-time boost, you can do that on PayPal, directed to our email address, funetworktv@gmail.com. We appreciate every dollar that we get, and all of it goes into continuing to make this programming and, as I said, make it go further and grow further. So thank you all for listening. I'm Stephen Kersner, and for Neil Wedewich and for my colleague Stephen Lawtons, thanks for listening, and we will talk to you again in a week.
This is fun! The FU Network!